or foul. The promise of membership one day without a timeline or any more precise notion of when it might occur was sufficiently strong to provoke Russia, as many warned at the time, including in the State Department and the administration, without offering Ukraine security guarantees substantial enough to deter eventual Russian aggression. So I think one can perfectly well understand why the Ukrainian leadership today is extremely sensitive to any sign that American and NATO support might be waning.
And Greg Anderson, could you speak specifically about the significance of Finland joining? Finland, of course, shares an 830-mile border with Russia.
I think to an extent, Finland's membership and what looks to be Sweden's membership don't change a lot. Both have been very active in the alliance for some time, including on the military side, participating in joint maneuvers and what have you. The prospect of actually creating a plan to defend, as you say, this extraordinarily long frontier with Russia does underscore the element of irrealism, I suppose, in alliance military planning.
And so explain, Gray Anderson, your piece co-authored with Thomas Meany in The New York Times is headlined, NATO isn't what it says it is. Explain what you mean by that, and what is NATO?
Well, NATO historically has claimed to be, I think, three things, really. The first is a collective defense organization, a military alliance. The second, an alliance of values. The third, an alliance of democracies. And so to take these three claims in reverse order, it's quite clear from the history of the alliance that the democratic character of member states was open to negotiation or perhaps observed more in the breach. Salazar's Portugal, of course, was a founding member. Greece, under the colonels, remained on good terms with the alliance. And today, I don't think anyone would argue that Turkey, Poland, say, Hungary, are great advertisements for the sort of liberal democracy touted by the alliance commanders. And on the question of values, I think much the same thing can be said. It bears mentioning, I suppose, as well, that when voters in member states or potential member states have shown signs of disapproving of membership or a lack of eagerness in enlisting in this American-led military organization, their voices have most often simply been dispensed with. On the specifically defense or security aggregating side of the equation, throughout the Cold War, NATO's claims to mount a conventional defense of Europe were always rather far-fetched and, I think, recognized as such. Since the end of the Cold War, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, one could in fact argue that far from strengthening European security, NATO, by precluding the creation of any more kind of coordinated, autonomous European defense, has actually weakened the member states that compose it. So I think on all three of those points, you know, one can say that NATO indeed isn't what it has professed to be. On the other hand, if you look at the history of U.S. debates around the alliance and its function, really from its inception, when the PAC turned into an organization at the turn of the 1950s, there was quite self-conscious recognition of the fact that this was an excellent vehicle for defending U.S. interests in Europe and preventing the emergence of any rival power that might threaten to hegemonize the continent. So in that respect, one has to say that there are deep continuities in NATO's functioning, and it has been a quite remarkable success.
And you write in the New York Times piece, quote, NATO is working exactly as it was designed by post-war U.S. planners, drawing Europe into a dependency on American power that reduces its room for maneuver. Far from a costly charity program, NATO secures American influence in Europe on the cheap. So if you could explain, how precisely is it that NATO's presence in Europe enables the U.S. to defend its own interests in Europe by weakening the capacity of sovereign European states to pursue their own defense objectives and economic, as you say?
Well, in a very concrete way, NATO, by imposing a regime theorized by Madeleine Albright in the 90s on the eve of the first big wave of post-Cold War expansion, described as the three Ds. That is to say, NATO, in its relationship to Europe, forbids any duplication of American capabilities by Europeans, any delinking of European security from American interests, American objectives, and any discrimination on the part of Europeans against non-EU NATO members. And one effect of that is, in a very kind of concrete way, to make Europeans dependent upon American doctrine, upon American materiel, weapon systems, leadership, command. So those are all ways, I suppose, in which this relationship of dependency is quite visible. There are less visible ways in which European dependence on the U.S. for security gives America leverage over other types of decision. So we might get to this in a minute, but if one looks at Europe's relationship to China currently in the context of Sino-American tensions, when the U.S. decided to impose effectively an embargo on certain types of technology, microchip technology, going to China, one really is struck by how quickly the Europeans fell in line, in particular the Dutch, who accepted, I think, just a couple of months ago, these restrictions. So that's sort of the tip of the iceberg, as it were, and what's most easily seen and quantified.
And finally, Gray Anderson, you quote in your piece French President Emmanuel Macron on the eve of a NATO summit 4 years ago, effectively saying that NATO was undergoing nothing short of, quote, brain death. In other words, the alliance was extremely weak. That was 4 years ago. So is it because of Russia's invasion that the alliance has now been not only resuscitated, but in fact strengthened?
Yeah, I think it's in part due to the invasion, although one might be tempted to look even further back. Since 2014, with the crisis in Ukraine, Russia's annexation of Crimea, one has seen greater outlays on defense on the part of Europeans and a kind of reassertion of America's role on the continent. This has gone through ups and downs. NATO throughout its history has famously been plagued by crises of one sort or another. But I think there's no arguing that over the past year or so, it has been dramatically strengthened, and America's hand in Europe quite remarkably strengthened as well.
Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us. Gray Anderson is the editor of NATO Politanism, the Atlantic Alliance since the Cold War. We'll link to your recent New York Times article, NATO Isn't What It Says It Is. Coming up, we look at the catastrophic rise of global hunger. مرغ سحر نور سر کن داغ مرا تازه تر کن داغ مرا of Dawn by Reem Khilani. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show looking at how chronic hunger is still much higher than before the COVID-19 pandemic began. This week, the United Nations released its annual report on the state of food security and nutrition in the world and found key drivers of food insecurity since 2019 were the pandemic, as well as extreme weather shocks and the war in Ukraine. This is World Food Program's Giancarlo Chiri and Marco Sanchez Cantillo with the UN Food and Agricultural Organization.
It is estimated that between 691 and 783 million people in the world face hunger in 2022. If we consider the mid-range, which is about 735 million people, it's still 122 million people more face hunger in 2022 compared to 2019 before the pandemic.
345 million people are facing acute food insecurity. This is a major increase when compared to 2020. It's a 200 million increase. It's a staggering.
The United Nations report found Africa remains the worst affected region, with one in five people facing hunger on the continent. Officials say they're currently far off track to end global hunger by 2030. For more, we're joined by two guests who serve on the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. In Austin, Texas, is Raj Patel, a research professor at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. And in Kampala, Uganda, we're joined by Milion Bilai, the General Coordinator of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now. Milion Bilai, I'd like to begin with you. If you could respond to the findings of this report, and in particular, why hunger has been rising in Africa for the last 10 years.
Thank you very much. This is staggering, as you say, and this is very concerning. For the last 10 years, hunger has been on an increase in Africa. This is buffeted by the stresses, you know, the COVID conflict and the climate crisis. All of these three are not from Africa. They haven't originated in Africa, the climate, the COVID and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, but we are suffering, and also there is an increase, even the availability of, there is a percentage increase in the shortage of good food, you know. But you know, when we are talking about these statistics, most of the time we don't put people's face to them. I heard, you know, a lot of people from representative countries, also leaders of the five UN bodies, talking about these numbers. But I'm not sure how much they are realizing that behind all these numbers there are people who are going to bed without food. The second thing for me is urbanization. Urbanization is important, but unplanned urbanization is disastrous. And I see it all over Africa, and it's also mentioned in the report. The quality of food in urban areas in Africa is decreasing. And also the crisis, the food crisis, the price crisis, affects rural people too. Rural people are very much affected. But what surprised me is, you know, the solution given by many of the speakers, the technology, digitization, increasing food production, and nobody's addressing the structural cause of this hunger. And I ask myself, always, why Africa? Why? You know, the report says that it is tapering off in Latin America and Asia, even though it is increasing in the Caribbean and Western Asia. But all of the countries in Africa are affected. So the question is why? I think some of the reasons can be, one, it is historical, starting from the slave trade and colonization and post-colonization, Africa is forced slowly but surely to commodify food and produce food for market, for outside market, mostly. And through the narrative of the Green Revolution, which says that, you know, you cannot produce food without using agrochemicals, without producing for the market, without using, you know, GMOs or hybridized seeds. You know, this kind of narratives is powerful narratives. And the debt crisis that we have, we are under it now, debt. It's really, really crippling the whole continent, and governments don't have money to allocate for produce for the production of food or to improve agricultural system. And on top of this is the elite capture of our countries and our system. That is an old and the product of the Green Revolution, and really not thinking about the country but themselves. The continent is captured by African elite. So all these structural problems are compounding the problem in Africa.
So Raj Patel, could you also respond to the findings of this report, and in particular, speak of where they say food security has increased? They say, for instance, that food insecurity is less prevalent now in Latin America and also in parts of Asia, but then in Africa, it's been in decline. Hunger has been increasing for the last 10 years.
So food insecurity, we're hearing so many numbers and so many different kinds of understandings of what hunger means. There's the sort of really chronic high-risk food insecurity when you're in a conflict area, undernutrition when you're in a conflict area. But food insecurity is the uncertainty about whether you will be able to eat over the next few days, weeks, or months. And 2.4 billion people are food insecure. But that security can be ameliorated not by, producing more food, as Million says, but actually by government interventions, by having a functioning social safety net. And there are places where governments have been able to divert funds during the pandemic to provide some sort of cushion for their citizens. But, the capacity to do that has a lot to do with, as Million mentioned, debt. And sub-Saharan Africa is particularly indebted and is part of a group of countries that is going to see its debt costs rising over the next couple of years, while other parts of the world see those debt ratios going down a little bit. So that's partly to a way of explaining why it is that some countries are able to provide good functioning safety nets, other things being equal, because they don't have creditors breathing down their necks. Sub-Saharan Africa, and in fact all of Africa, is particularly under the thumb not just of lenders like the World Bank or bilateral individual country donors, but also the private sector. Things have changed rather dramatically over the past couple of decades, where 20 years ago, really the big lenders to countries in the global south were agencies like the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, these multilateral donors. But increasingly, private sector lenders are lending to governments, and their interest rates are higher, and they demand to be paid. And that's a problem when we're experiencing food price inflation and when we're experiencing surges in the levels of interest rates. So if you're a government in Africa, you're having to make some very difficult choices about whether to divert what funds you are able to muster to make sure that your citizens are fed, or you pay back your private sector creditors.
And so who are these?
Certainly one of the, sorry
to interrupt you, Raj, but who are these private sector creditors, and what are the terms of the loans that they give to countries?
Well, certainly private sector loans are a few points higher in terms of interest rate than the concessional loans that are given by the World Bank. So the terms are not as generous. They're able to sort of be a bit more agile in terms of their lending, which is why governments tend to go to them. But there is this sort of shift towards borrowing from either lenders who are interested in infrastructure, lenders who are interested in buying up land. And those those lenders can either be local private capital markets, or they can be international pension funds, for example, endowments for universities. We've seen a lot of very interesting and important action, for instance, against the Harvard Endowment from activists in Brazil who have observed that the endowment is involved in certain kinds of lending activity that involve land grabbing. So the private sector lenders themselves vary, but what's always true is that their loans are more expensive and onerous when it comes to this financing. And I think one thing that gets forgotten in all of this is, how is it that governments are repaying the loans? They're growing food not for local consumption, but for export. And this is the vast irony here, is that food is being grown, but it's not being grown for local consumption. It's being grown for us in the global north to eat, or worst case, to be fed to animals that then richer consumers get to eat. And so here's this deep irony that we're talking about structurally higher rates of hunger around the world, and the way that governments are trying to pay off the debts that they're incurring trying to feed people is by growing food not for consumption by the local populations, but for export.
So, Milan Balai, I want to ask you about kind of the structural conditions under which these loans are being given, what kinds of food systems are in place and are being promoted. You recently co-authored an open letter to USAID that called on it to fund sustainable food systems in Africa, not another industrial green revolution. It began, quote, "We are dismayed to learn that the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, recently solidified its relationship with AGRA, that is formerly the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and committed to working with AGRA to transform African food and agriculture systems." Could you explain your concerns?
I think AGRA, as its name implies, is Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, and the research we've done, after AGRA has implemented what it planned to implement. By the way, it's mainly supported by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the USAID, and other aid agencies, and also private philanthropies. Their contribution is not as much as Bill and Melinda Gates aid. So they operated for about 15 years. And we evaluated their outcomes, and they failed. One area that they have succeeded and that they are still pushing is changing policies and also regulations. Regulation related to seed, regulation related to biosafety regulations, and also fertilizer regulations. So, on the things that they are said that they would succeed, meaning increased food for productivity, halving the malnutrition, and whatever. But what they have resulted in the end is a decrease in the diversity and amount of production of indigenous food, So we have looked at this research, and I think they have done also their own assessment, which incorporated what we have said. In light of this, we wrote to all of their funders and have asked them to defund AGRA. AGRA can be a very good force if it converts itself into an agroecology, an organization which pushes agroecology. But looking at the funders, looking at the people who are interested in its work, looking at its purpose, looking at the board membership of AGRA, we don't think that would happen. It's mostly outside control. You know that it's registered in the U.S. also. It's not African. So that's why we have asked an entity in the U.S. which is using public money to fund AGRA, to stop funding AGRA.
Raj Patel, could you also talk about that? What are the food aid systems in place, which critics say, in fact, may be exacerbating hunger conditions, and if not exacerbating them, certainly not improving them?
Well, I mean, historically, the United States was tethered to a way of providing food aid that really was about shipping U.S. food in U.S. carriers to different parts of the world as a way of providing a prop for local food, local farmers and industrial food producers. But what we're seeing more particularly, as Milan is saying, with things like the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA, as it's now called, because it doesn't want to be known by the Green Revolution name. They think it's bad branding. But what you're seeing there is funding for the transformation of agricultural systems towards providing more processed food for cities. And as Miljan was saying, I mean, this new state of the food of the world's food security report has another very new, interesting figure, well, one that I hadn't seen before, which is the figure of the number of people on Earth who are able to afford a healthy meal. And it turns out that 3.4 billion people cannot afford to eat healthily. Now, this is striking when set alongside something like the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which is very interested in processing and you know, growing food for cities in ways that are not necessarily consonant with healthy diets, but are much more around supporting industrialized food systems, and in particular, moving us towards ultra-processed food. And that's a grave source of concern, not least because it tends to be more expensive. You know, the health effects are increasingly being questioned by the nutrition community. But in general, the question of how it is that we're going to feed cities sustainably, not just in Africa, but around the world, is one that is gradually coming to the fore. And unfortunately, our economic policy, our agricultural policy, our food systems policy, not just in the global south, but around the world, is not fit for purpose. It was set up to really support large industrial food producers, you know, providing packaged and ultra-processed food cheaply for workers in cities. But as it becomes clearer that, first of all, that food is expensive, unaffordable, has vast environmental impacts, and now increasingly it's clear is unhealthy, all of that suggests that we need a real turnaround in our agriculture, food and aid policy. And the agencies tasked with overseeing that are doing very little to address it.
And Raj, if you could address what is now an immediate possible threat to food access, Russian President Vladimir Putin threatening to abandon the Black Sea grain deal brokered by the UN and Turkey, which grants Ukraine safe passage to export food and fertilizer. Unless Russia agrees to an extension, the agreement will expire as soon as Monday. If you could talk about the significance of this and what impact it will have if the agreement expires.
Well, these agreements have often been grounds for a certain amount of speculation on international commodity markets, not just, as you say, for food, but also for fertilizer. Fertilizer costs have dropped since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, where there was a frenzy of buying up and speculation. But it's still at levels of far higher than before the conflict started, but also far higher since before the pandemic. And this is an ongoing problem in two ways. First of all, there's the risk of a commodity price spike. For producers, that's going to raise prices. For consumers, prices have continued to increase, and this will merely add to that misery. But by increasing the price of fertilizer, you kind of lock in these price increases for grain producers that farm industrially. And that augurs very badly, not just for the short-term food price spikes, but for the medium to long-term as well.
And finally, and very briefly, Miljan Bilai, if you could talk about some of the community-based organizations that are working for food justice across Africa.
AFSA, as you know, is a network of networks. We work with 50 networks all over Africa, 50 in 50 of the 55 African countries. We have a number of members. And quite recently, we published a book, which is called Stories of Change, Agroecology as a Climate Adaptation Approach. This is written by local people themselves, you know, people who are actually practicing agroecology, who are increasing productivity, planting diverse foods, reclaiming, you know, areas which are degraded, and experimenting with biological seeds, you know, for resilience production system, food forests. In a lot of cases, 12 cases, in the number of cases are increasing. And we have been also accumulating a lot of cases. So local community.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Miljan Bilai. Thank you so much for joining us, General Coordinator of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, Raj Patel, Research Professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. Happy birthday, Karl Marxer. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Thank you so much for joining us.
Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.
You're listening.